we are now going to start the second book. I don't care if it says number 4 on your book. That is a dirty lie that was formulated in the pits of hell. So this is book number 2. So just kind of chat a little bit. We're going to just kind of catch people up in a broad sense. We won't get super detailed on what happened in the first book, but a little bit about the Chronicles as a whole, about C.S. Lewis as a whole. So why did I make the point that this is book number 2, even though it says on the cover book number 4? Anybody remember why?
Well, there's a gap in time here.
There is a gap in time, but this is what happens. C.S. Lewis writes the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as the first book. And it was so well received, he was asked to continue writing. And so he did so with this next book, a very clear sequel, Prince Caspian. He will write 2 more books in chronological sequence. The next book will involve some of these same characters, FYI, and it will be called The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and then there's a little bit of an overlap as well to the following book, The Silver Chair. After he wrote those 4 books, he was always being asked about what happened in between books, or what happened before, or what about this, and what about that. So he was kind of caught, do I continue the story, or do I work backwards and fill the gaps? Now these days, in the realm of movie franchises, nobody blinks an eye with the concept of the prequel. But prequels hadn't really been invented as such back then. And it's not that people never did that, never wrote retroactively, but this is still pretty novel. So what he does is the 5th book, The Horse and His Boy, moves backwards. And it actually occurs during the time of the first book. So if you recall from the first book, they're actually in Narnia for a long time. By the end of it, these 4 children are grown men and women. And the horse and his boy actually pulls an adventure out of the time when they were grown men and women. And as a matter of fact, it's not really about them. But it does occur within that time frame. The next book, the 6th book, The Magician's Nephew, goes all the way back to the beginning of the creation of Narnia. And it explains how Narnia came to be, a lot of the things that we see as naturally occurring within Narnia are given an explanation and an origin. And then the last book, The Last Battle, the 7th book, is really a final book and a final part of the story, both chronologically and as far as the narrative is concerned. So at some point, years after the fact, there was a dispute about what order should the books be published in. Should they be published in a set? How do you read them? Do you read them in the order they were published in, or do you read them in the order of the narrative so that the Magician's Nephew talking about the origins of Narnia comes first. That's the big dispute. And C.S. Lewis himself responded in a letter to some little girl saying, oh, whatever makes most sense. And yeah, sure, it makes sense to read The Magician's Nephew first. And so within, you know, people who, you know, really love Narnia, there's this consternation about, oh, what do we do? And I find it very simple. You read it in the order he wrote them. A, because that's the way that God intends. B, it's because there is so much about the first book that is so enchanting about discovering this world. I think it loses something somewhat precious if you read The Magician's Nephew first, which is very purposefully trying to explain and fill in gaps. I think as a narrative whole, it works better retroactively. So I will not condemn you if you read it out of order, but I will look down on you. You'll be lesser in my eyes.
My diction has it. Really, I mean, Prince Caspian is right smack in the middle of the book.
So, let's go back and just kind of reset our groundwork for ourselves and for anyone who wasn't with us to those last classes. C.S. Lewis, one of the most famous Christian authors of the 20th century, one of the most famous Christian apologists of the 20th century. An apologist is someone who makes the argument, makes the case for Christianity. He was, frankly, one of the finest minds in English history. He is known mostly for things like his popular works, but he was a world-class scholar, most especially in English language and literature. He taught at both Oxford and Cambridge, and it was at Oxford where, as a young scholar, after serving in World War I, he became acquainted with this group of like-minded scholars who eventually grew up into the group referred to as the Inklings. They were, they were academics, they were lawyers, they were poets, they were writers. It was this, the sharpest, smartest kids, and they all hung out, and they all tested and tried and laughed and cried with each other, and it became this like little club, this little group that is this really fascinating convergence of some truly brilliant minds who all went to the same bar and hung out, for years. J.R.R. Tolkien of the Lord of the Rings fame was one of the other prominent Inklings. And it is, it's Tolkien and Owen Barfield, another one of the Inklings, who are really instrumental in returning C.S. Lewis to faith in Christ. Though he was raised nominally as an Anglican in Northern Ireland, his mother died when he was quite young. She suffered and lingered, I think it was a cancer of some sort, and his fervent prayers for her healing went unanswered. And as a young man, he very angrily lost his faith and was a very committed atheist all the way through his schooling, which was troubled at times, until he was finally sent to a brilliant but also atheistic tutor who he always referred to as the Great Knock. He was a Scottish scholar and the son of a Presbyterian pastor, and was always insistent upon sterling crystal logic. And being tested and tried by someone who wasn't going to let C.S. Lewis get away with the tiniest slip up of language, or the tiniest assumption, or unchallenged comment, taught Lewis, again from this early age, to have a mind that was sharp, that was focused, that was precise, that was logical, and that could argue and defend absolutely any position. So, most of the other young men of that age, he was called to serve in the Great War, where he, like other men, saw true horror and the death of friends. His own best friend, as a matter of fact, was killed in the war. And if you ever read a biography of C.S. Lewis, he had kind of this odd relationship with an older woman for many years, where she lived in his household. And a lot of people were very confused. Was it romantic? Was it not romantic? Was it, it didn't quite seem mother-son, but it was just kind of odd. This was the mother of his best friend, and he had made a promise as his friend was killed in the war that if anything ever happened to him, he would take care of his mother, and he did. For decades, he cared for this woman. And was there ever a romantic element to it? Maybe. It was weird. But that's where it comes from. And so he knows loss and he knows tragedy. He lives as a bachelor for most of his life with his younger brother, Warney. Again, it's through the testing and proving with these other young, you know, intellectual academics like Tolkien, that he encounters arguments for the existence and truth of God that he, as a man of logic, can no longer deny. And when you read his own autobiography, Surprised by Joy, there's this beautiful passage where he just kind of breaks down and acknowledges that, you know, God was God and that was that, except, you know, he has this take on himself that normally when you consider a prodigal son, you know, the father embraces him, but the son is like, he's like, come back, and he's all sad, and oh, I'm so sorry. You know, he's remorseful, and he's like, I wasn't like that at all. I was, you know, he's like really ticked off that God existed and that he knew it. And so, you know, he describes himself as acting more like a caged animal with his eyes darting from side to side, looking if there's any way of possibly escaping, because he did not want to acknowledge what he finally realized was the truth, that God was God and that was that. He became at that point what he would refer to as a theist, meaning someone who believes in the existence of God. And it didn't take much longer after that before he came to a fuller faith as God revealed through his son Jesus Christ, became a practicing Anglican within the Church of England, and began writing books in defense of Christianity. During World War II, his speaking and his essay writing was so popular that the BBC asked him to do a series of radio lectures on Christianity and faith, really for the morale of the people. You know, the war was not going well early on. And, you know, rather than break down and give up, how, you know, you've got this island committed to never surrendering, but how do we do that in a practical sense? And his series of lectures, as they were recorded, they were transcribed into articles, which are now contained in the book Mere Christianity. Again, those were first a radio broadcast. And he became kind of world-renowned because of that. And he writes the Chronicles of Narnia after the war with the desire to, in the words of his friend Tolkien, baptize the imagination. He always loved fairy tales. He loved myths. He loved these stories of, you know, heroes and fanciful times, and especially he loved Norse mythology in particular. But he, like Tolkien, worked out this understanding to see that myth is simply a story offering an explanation of what the world is and why it is the way that it is, and that in Christ you see the one true myth that all these other myths kind of spring from. You know, a lot of cultures have a dying God. A lot of cultures have, you know, these little elements that you could sort of see, well, I wonder, you know, who borrowed this from that, and is somebody copying someone or whatever. That to call Christianity a myth doesn't say Christianity is untrue. A myth is simply a story to explain what is, and it just so happens, he would say, that the myth of Scripture is true. It is there to explain what is, how it happened, what it means, and this one is true. And it's written on our hearts. That's why all these different cultures have little elements and fragments, not because we're all copying each other, because we are built by the same God. And if he has communicated to us through Christ our Lord, it would only make sense, like people stumbling around in the dark, the cultures who do not know him directly would still gain fragments and glimpses and pieces. So the Narnia books come from his desire to recreate some fairy tales, to tell fairy stories, especially to... these are mostly children of friends who see him as kind of Uncle Jack, you know, kindly man with no children of his own who, you know, kind of treats them, you know, not in a childish fashion, but kind of, you know, treats them with respect, but still as children. And the first book was actually written for his goddaughter, was dedicated to his goddaughter, Lucy. And the dedication is very sweet. It's like, you know, by the time I finish this, you're going to be too old for fairy tales, but my hope is I'll still be around when you get old enough to enjoy them again. You know, good stories are good stories, but there's something that happens when we start getting kind of nervous or we start getting self-conscious about certain stories as being too childish. You know, we hit that kind of pubescent age or whatever, and we don't want to be thought of as little kids. Or it's not cool, or whatever it is. But eventually, the hope is you get old enough, that you become mature enough, that you go back to the things that give you true joy and pleasure. And the only thing childish is allowing what you think, other people think of you, to stop you. So, he writes the story that sets in an imaginary world, which interestingly enough, connects to stories that he and his brother used to tell each other when they were children. I forget the name of the land they created when they were boys, like Boxum or Boxlin or something like that. But basically, he referred to them as dressed animal stories. They weren't necessarily fanciful creatures. These were more animals who had everyday human occupations. You know, that rabbit might be a very boring banker, and that will, I mean, yeah. it's amazing. His imagination was both wonderful and weird at the same time. You're gonna imagine this land populated with talking animals, and they're all gonna be like, you know, bankers and attorneys. Weird. So he begins to kind of dig back into his own personal history, as well as start appealing to these other myths that he's appreciated over the years, and then tie it into the biblical story. So, as we discovered in the first book, the main characters are the four Pevensey children. They are, you know, Peter the oldest is, I think we figured he's probably about 12 in that book, and then Susan is next, then Edmund, and then Lucy. So we're guessing they're probably, you know, between the ages of like 12 to 7, 6 years old, somewhere around there. So they're relatively young. Peter is not really a teenager yet, I don't think. They live in London, and this is the time of the Blitz. And so, like a lot of the children of London, they are relocated out in the country for their safety. And they are taken to this somewhat mysterious and foreboding, yet also super awesome kind of mansion out in the countryside that is owned by this old professor that they never really see. And so in one of their times of playing around, the youngest, Lucy, finds that through a simple game of hide and seek and hiding in a wardrobe, that's like kind of a closety sort of thing, that she is transported to a completely different world. In this world, she meets a faun, as the Greek mythology, you know, with the little cloven hooves on his feet and stuff like that, and makes a friend, yet finds out that this land is under the curse of a witch, and it's always winter and never Christmas. Initially, the other children don't believe her. The second son, Edmund, also manages to stumble into this world, meeting the witch instead of the faun, and setting into motion a whole story of betrayal and of lies and deceit. And by the time all of the children come into Narnia, Edmund has been seduced and eventually captured by the witch, by the queen. The four children seem to be connected to an ancient prophecy that when the four thrones of Caer Paravel, the capital castle, were filled by sons of Adam and daughters of Eve, that is humans, that the witch's reign would be over. These talking animals who populate Narnia, they are befriended by first beavers and then all sorts of other things when they find out that Aslan, the great lion, the lord of the wood, the son of the emperor over the sea, the figure of Christ within Narnia, was there. And this story rolls forward with a very much a Christ and gospel story. C.S. Lewis was always very twitchy about calling things an allegory. He didn't like allegories. He thought allegories were lazy. You know, X equals Y, 1 equals 2, this person is really that person. That always annoyed him. But I gotta say, it sort of feels like an allegory to me, where lots of stuff that happens within the story, such as the treachery of Edmund and our own sin with the witch, like the devil, like death, with winter, like the consequences of that sin, with Aslan giving his life for the sake of the traitor. And even though the witch thinks that she has won, magic that goes deeper than the creation of the world itself now comes into play, and Aslan is resurrected, and the forces of good Narnia triumph over winter and sin and death, and the four children are made kings and queens of Narnia with Peter as the High King, and they reign for many years, growing in maturity and stature and having adventures and stuff like that. And then one day they manage to stumble right back out of the same wardrobe they had gone into at the beginning of the story and find themselves, rather than in their 20s and 30s as mature monarchs, they're the exact same kids that they were. And
the great old time machine.
And in England, it's as though not a moment had passed.
They've been in there a long time and a half.
It so turns out that the professor knew all about Narnia and encouraged them that he didn't think their stories were done, but that they wouldn't be able to go back the same way. And instead, they just ought to be prepared for whatever comes next. For as he reminded them at the end, once a king or queen in Narnia,
always
a king or queen in Narnia. All right, that's all of our background. Yeah.
And did they stay there a year before they went back? Did I understand that?
That's what it said in this book.
Yeah.
But it said they were there years and years.
No, she means did they stay at the house?
They stay with the professor.
The professor for a year.
No.
I think it was in the summer. It was in summer.
Yeah, because they're going back to school. I think they went home.
Yeah.
They were supposed to go home, and then that's where this starts, the magic.
I am not 100% on that, to be honest.
It sounds
whether they had been, I get the impression they've gone back home over the course of that year. But regardless,
they must have, because they said that the mother had made sandwiches.
Well, that's right. Mother made sandwiches, and I just got my torch, my flashlight, my birthday last week. Okay.
Well, they were getting on a train to go back to go to school.
Yes, boarding school. So again, whoever said it reminds me of Harry Potter, well, remember how every Harry Potter book starts going off to school on the train.
Right.
So. Same thing. They've ostensibly moved back to London with their mother at some point over the year. But it's been a full year since they have been in Narnia. And it's now time to get back to normal life. Between the Blitz and the relocation and everything else, I do get the impression they have not been back to school since. That this year has been kind of like a year off. But now, between the relocation and summertime, the holidays are done. And so it's time to go back to school. This is Lucy's first year at boarding school. Mm-hmm. So they're all leaving. So they have taken a train journey out of London into the countryside, all four of them together. And then they're waiting at this, you know, little sleepy station where eventually one train's going to take the girls to their school and one train's going to take the boys to their school. Do I understand the English boarding school system? Not particularly. Is that completely different than what we would do for our own children? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But is it their system? Yeah. Yes. It is what it is. So this is where we find ourselves a year later, and they are prepared for school. And even though C.S. Lewis is writing this in his, I don't know, 40s or 50s, boy, does he have it right as far as kids are concerned. Like, that first part of the journey was still like being on holiday.
Yeah.
The first part of the train ride where they're all together. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they separate and they're going to get in those trains for their final destination, like that foreboding doom.
That feeling.
Ugh, sadness. School.
Yeah.
All right.
But also separation.
Well, and this is you know, Lucy's first time, and she's got to be nervous regardless.
Yeah.
You know, even though that's their system, I've got to think that that first time you go,
terrified.
Yeah.
Especially
Yeah, again, my guess is she's probably about 7 years old. Maybe she's 8, but maybe not. But that's about when it would start. All right, so they're all a little older. You know, maybe Peter's a teenager now. He might be 13 years old. Maybe he's even 14. But it's like that, plus or minus. And so they are waiting their different trains to come. And you can just almost sort of feel the... in the room. And then what happens?
They get snatched away.
They get snatched away, but first...
They're feeling like getting a poke or pull.
A poke and a sting and a yank and a jerk and a grab. And they don't know what's going on, but it's something weird. And of all people, who figures out what it is first? Did you catch that?
Edmund.
It's Edmund.
Edmund.
Yes. Edmund says this feels like magic.
Yes.
Now, this isn't followed up on, but I just always find that to be one of those little touches where C.S. Lewis cares about this story. He cares about it making sense. He cares about these as real people. And of all four of them, who has the most experience with magic?
Edmund.
Is it good experience?
No.
But he knows.
He remembers.
He knows.
Yeah.
And he's the one who says this feels like magic. Mm-hmm. So they all grab hands. Mm-hmm. And they're going to go together. So they are pulled away. And they find themselves where?
Down in the woody hills.
In a forest.
Yeah. They're deep in a forest. Do they recognize this forest?
No.
Can they see very far in this forest?
No.
So they don't know where they are. They don't know what's going on. Where do they suspect they are? Where do they assume they are?
Did they think they were back?
They think we're probably in Narnia. But they don't know anything about where they are or what's going on. But they've been transported to a new place in some magical fashion. It's, you know, they have immediately said, I wonder if this is Narnia.
Yeah.
But they don't recognize anything, do they?
No.
Okay, so they have to work their way to a spot where they can just kind of see, where it's just not trees and brush everywhere. So what's the first thing they see? And they finally get to the open.
Sea.
They come to the sea.
Yeah.
They come to the sea. They make it to a beach. And it opens up, and there is this lovely, cool, calm water.
And it's hot.
And they want to splash around and, you know, do what kids do. And, there's some very... again, this is why... People who don't have children, adults who don't have children, tend to treat small children in one of two ways. This is my experience, and feel free to know differently. One way is they kind of don't know what to do with them. And so they're like, they're there, little girl. Can you hear me? You know, they act like every child is very stupid and deaf. And, yeah. And then the other type kind of treats them like they're on, they have sort of like an in-joke together.
Yeah.
They treat them very much like they're equals, but not in a, you know, call me Dave sort of way, but just in a way that it sort of elevates the child a little bit. Like, it takes them seriously.
Yeah.
And they might even kind of, it's me and you together, right? You know, and it's there's a comfort to it, and the child, you know, kind of really responds to that.
Right.
You know, kids don't like being treated like kids.
No.
They like being treated older, more mature, even maybe than they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if Lewis was writing for kids and he thought the kids were dumb, I don't think he would have had this lengthy section where they're like, well, what about our shoes, and what about our coats, and what about our sandwiches, and what about this, and what about that? But he's employing these details because, A, they're kind of real. I mean, that's what would legitimately happen. They're not with a super amount of detail, as though, you know, we were all grown-ups that were very interested in, you know, survival techniques or something.
Yeah.
But it all kind of comes up very naturally. And very easily, and in ways that I think kids would appreciate, like, oh yeah, maybe they should eat those sandwiches, I bet they would go bad. You know, oh yeah, I could see wanting to leave my shoes, but then probably shouldn't. You know, and it all kind of works. So, what are some of the things they have to figure out along the way? I've already said sandwiches and shoes, what else?
Water.
Water.
Very thirsty. So.
Yeah, they're going to be, you know, you know, at some point, fresh water is going to become super important, and they know enough to know what about fresh water?
That it flows into the ocean.
Flows into the ocean. Okay, so at some point, if we walk along the coastline, we're going to find a stream.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just how it works. And so they're smart, and they're thinking through this, and they even decided, you know, they're going to take the coats and not leave them. They're going to put their shoes back on, even though it would be nicer to walk in the cool water. And they sort of have to trudge along. And then, rather than finding a stream immediately, what do they find out instead?
They're on an island.
They're on an island. But they find out that they're on an island.
Oh, yeah.
So rather than just on a coastline where eventually you would come across a stream, they come to a point where they can see across and realize, you know, if they kept walking, they're just going to go in a big circle. We're on an island, and the coast is going to stop. So, does that mean that they died of thirst because they were on an island?
No.
What happens next?
Kept going.
They find a stream.
Because they know it's going to be salty. Maybe.
Yeah.
Right? Again, smart, sensible, not overly technical. And so they go on up the stream. Now, how might you describe their mood at this point?
Probably getting a little edgy because they're tired and thirsty.
Yeah, it was super awesome initially.
It's hot.
You know, why would it be super awesome initially?
Yeah, not going to school.
Not going to school! That's right. So, they're super excited about the fact that they're not going to school right now. And I think they would probably be excited that, you know, I think we're back in Narnia.
New adventure.
But after a while, you know, it's getting hot and I'm getting tired and we're thirsty and nothing's happened yet. You know, so.
Be alone at this point, right?
Yeah.
We're going to need water.
Yeah, now we're moving from the this is cool to wait a second, we have to kind of think through this now because, you know, we don't have anything. They have.
Only two sandwiches, too.
That's right. Yeah. So they have to split them up, and everybody only gets half a sandwich. And even the little kid, half a sandwich isn't very much.
No.
All right. So, as they are now kind of in the mood of thinking through, okay, we might be here for a while, and we don't have anything, so we might need to shift from play around mode to survival mode. Lucy smells and sees something. What is it?
Apples.
Apples.
She finds an apple tree. How interesting. And so this beautiful apple tree, and it's filled with apples, and they notice it's not just one apple tree.
It was an orchard.
It's an orchard. But what kind of orchard? Not just apple, but what's the state of the orchard?
It's overgrown.
This is not a farmed orchard. This looks like it's been abandoned forever ago, and it's just kind of gone wild. So there's just trees growing every which way, and even growing to and through an old stone wall.
It reminds me of that movie or book, The Secret Garden. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I thought of when I,
yeah,
I love that sort of movie.
Yeah. Me too.
So they go up to the wall, they kind of push their way through the branches of the bramble, and on the other side of the wall, what do they discover? This is not just a wall. We are now we're now in the open, and we see the ruins around us. We see an archway. We see buildings. We see, you know, they're in some sort of ancient ruins. How long ago? Was this recently abandoned, or was this been abandoned for
a long time?
Okay. How long do they think?
Ages ago.
Hundreds of years. If you've ever been to ruins, it is quite fascinating, I think, to consider with your imagination, you look at something and to fill in the pieces, you know, with what it looked like when it was, it wasn't this, you know, historical site, but it was just somebody's daily living place. I know Europe's got to be filled with stuff like that. Down in Peru, Machu Picchu is super amazing. It's basically this terraced city built on the side of the mountain in the middle of nowhere with these giant stones that they brought from miles and miles away. Nobody knows how. And they cut and shape them in such a way that all these giant stones fit all over the city like puzzle pieces. It's kind of like the mystery of the pyramids. You're like, how did they make the pyramids so precise? Well, that's sort of like Machu Picchu, where they figured out how to irrigate their crops and get water up by terracing everything. And so it's this technological innovation. It's an architectural innovation. It was this really amazing place. But when it was discovered by Hiram Bingham in like 1918 or something like that, it had been deserted for hundreds and hundreds of years. No record of who or what happened. I mean, they were Inca, but nobody knows anything about it. Why did they leave? It was abandoned. Even the other tribes in the area didn't know about it. So it's this great mystery. Like, they did all these amazing things and then vanished. But to walk through these things and imagine it, you know, as a working city filled with people just kind of going about their daily business. So, as the children are walking around these ancient ruins, what are they thinking about?
They're comparing it a bit to the castle that they were in when they were in Narnia. Yeah,
that's right. So, interestingly enough, they don't have to imagine a what if this was like a place that where people used to live.
Yeah.
They actually lived a life like that.
Right.
A year ago, they had a castle, and they had a courtyard, and they had, you know, all of these things where they don't have to think, I wonder what that was for. Like, I mean, they knew what it was like to live in a castle, in an operating, working, real castle.
They discovered that the well was kind of in the same place.
Okay, so they find a well with some water. It's getting kind of late. So, you know, rather than do a whole lot more, what do they want to do?
Build a fire,
find some shelter. Let's, you know, we don't want to be stumbling around some unknown place in the dark. So we're just going to kind of set up camp at this spot that looks good.
Is it strange that
good.
Peter would have matches? In the beginning, I thought, you know, in today's time, a child with matches.
No, it would be perfectly sensible.
Because lighting candle.
Sure. Yeah. Well, kids had matches.
He was going to school, and
Kids had matches. Kids had knives.
That must have been part of
You know, you might be in a place that required lighting a candle rather than flipping a switch. It's just sort of one of those things. You know, it would be not only unbelievable, it would be impossible to conceive a child in the 40s saying, Your 8-year-old has a telephone? A telephone. And they carry it with them? Why? Yeah. You know, and now we've got, you know, children with smartphones and whatever. But it, yeah, they're penalty matches. Just one of those things. Just one of those things. Everybody is feeling kind of weird about this. It's interesting and exciting, but it's also a little unsettling, and there's just kind of there's a sense about it that they can't completely grasp.
They do realize that this is their castle.
Not yet.
Eventually.
They just feel odd.
Yeah.
They recognize some things, but they recognize them in the sense that, well, that's where such and such ought to be in a castle. We know castles, and like the dais where the High King sits, I mean, that's what you do. So I'm pretty sure it probably would have been right there. They haven't put two and two together yet, because why in the world would you? Their castles were not a ruin. What changes everything? What's the moment that changes from I wonder where we are to knowing exactly where they are?
When they open the apple on the door.
Not quite the door. The chess piece. Susan finds a chess piece. That's right. And she's initially choked up because it looks so similar to one that she had. And it's Peter who finally says, we've been idiots.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have, and you know, interestingly enough, the old professor might have gotten for their lack of logic. Mm-hmm. You know, just because you think it can't be your castle because it's a ruin, who says your castle can't be a ruin? If all the pieces fit, mm-hmm. that's the truth. And they've now realized this is Narnia. And this is our castle. This abandoned ruin. It looks like no one has lived here for hundreds of years. We were a year ago. This place was filled with people and animals and creatures and all of our stuff. And now they're overwhelmed. And where do they realize they are in relation to a spot in the castle?
In the ruins of the...
Caravel, the castle. But this ivy wall that they've camped up against... What is that actually?
There should be a door to the treasury.
Door to the treasury. Yes. They clear it away, and they make it down. How do they get light?
Torch.
No. They try to.
They use the torch at first.
Edmund has a flashlight.
Okay. Right. Now, when you see Edmund's torch, just remember that's an Englishism. Yes. Read Edmund's flashlight.
Yeah.
An electric torch is a flashlight, and they try and stick torches that don't work, so they use the electric torch, the flashlight. They count the steps are correct, they know for sure. And then suddenly, like, within this treasure room, they just recognize, it all comes flooding back. All everything they pick up. Oh my gosh, do you remember this? Do you remember that guy who did that thing, and this happened, and he gave me that, and we did this, and...
Sword. I have a question. I got mixed up, or I can't remember. Is Claire
Paravel?
Care? Paravel.
Paravel. That's not the witch's castle.
No.
No.
So where? So.
This is the castle that was on the seashore, where they first, in the area of where they first met Aslan, and this is at the end of the book where they are, where they're consecrated kings and queens. It was empty.
It was dead.
It was waiting.
Before the kids became kings and queens, Kir Paravel sat empty.
Empty.
And that was part of the prophecy. There are four thrones at Kir Paravel, and when they're filled with humans, then the witch's reign will be over.
Okay. Yeah. But the witch had a castle.
She had a little castle somewhere else. Correct.
Okay.
So, they are looking at all this stuff, and all these memories are flooding back, and rather than simply reminisce indefinitely, number one, what's their number one priority right now?
Getting slumpy, right?
Was it food?
We've got to save the battery.
Oh, that's right.
Got to save the battery. You know, remember how foolish it would be to lock oneself in a wardrobe?
Well, yeah.
Save that battery. So they realize that their time is limited, and they, you know, we can explore again in the morning.
When there's light.
But before they go, there is something they have to do. What do they have to do?
Well, don't they find their special gifts?
We have to find the gifts.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
what are the gifts?
The sword, the shield, the horn.
Okay, but what are the gifts?
Oh, they're protection.
They got them at Christmas.
They were given
Christmas. They got them at Christmas from whom?
Father Christmas
gave them these gifts because now, after being always winter and never Christmas, it was finally Christmas. And Father Christmas gives them, he says, these are not toys, they are, remember, tools. So, what is given to Peter?
A sword
and a shield. Okay, what's famous about the sword?
He uses it fairly early on,
he saves his sisters from being attacked by the giant wolf who was the chief of secret police.
Yeah.
Remember, Aslan says, let the prince earn his spurs.
Yeah.
So, that's his first battle and his first victory. What does Susan get from Father Christmas?
Not the oil.
She gets a bow and arrow.
Lucy has it.
And?
A horn.
What's interesting about the horn?
Help will come.
As a matter of fact, to go back to that same moment, Peter knows to go rescue his sisters from the wolf when they hear Susan's horn.
Yeah.
So, you know, you blow the horn and help is supposed to come. So, what did Lucy get?
This vial,
it's like diamond, but there's just cordial on the inside and it heals wounds and illnesses and all that kind of stuff.
He used it on Edmund.
That's right, after he had been grievously injured, fighting the witch.
Yeah.
What did Edmund get?
Nothing.
Why did Edmund not get any gifts?
Because he was with the witch.
Yeah.
He was not there with them when Father Christmas arrived.
That's right.
So, I mean, imagine for a moment, they're getting these gifts down, and he's there by himself.
Yeah.
He didn't complain about it, but there's got to be a little catch in the throat. Because not so much, I don't think, because, you know, Edmund's become a very, very, very different man.
He is.
But not so much like they have something and I don't, but more along the lines of regret, remorse. I remember the kid I used to be and that little snot missed out on those gifts. So as they are gathering the gifts, what's one thing they do note about the gifts?
The horn is missing.
There's no horn. They can't call for help. Got the sword, got the shield, got the cordial, even Susan with her bow and arrow, and the bow is so awesome that after all this time, the string is still good. But there's no horn that they can use to call for help. So, what have they also figured out about this island?
That it's Narnia, but that there's been a change because Narnia was a promontory. It just
Cair Paravel used to be on an isthmus.
Yeah.
But so much time has passed, the trees have gone overgrown, and that isthmus the channel has now gone all the way through, and Cair Paravel is now on an island. So, what does that tell you about how long it's been?
Many, many years.
It has just been a very, very long time. Long enough for trees to grow, long enough for streams to turn into rivers, to cut through rock and sand and dirt and turn an isthmus into, or a peninsula even, into an island. And yet, some way, somehow, here they are. They figured out where they are. What they don't know is when they are. And that's kind of where the chapter stops. So, all I will say, and this is what we're starting off with, if the first book started off with kind of an adventure, a fantastical adventure of Lucy through the wardrobe early on, and I wonder what's going to happen next, this one almost starts with a mystery. Mm-hmm. What's going on? We now know where we are, but the when, the why, none of that makes sense yet. And we are going to have to discover the deeper meaning behind how they would be in a Narnia that seems both
so
completely familiar and so completely unfamiliar because it's been so very, very long in observation of what they see since they've actually lived there.
Plus the magic, how they got there. That was kind of weird too.
We don't have an explanation for that either. All right?
Yep,
okay. So we good? Okay. What do we want to do? We want to do two chapters for next time?
Yeah.
Okay. There it goes. Thank you.